This is the Greenlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greenlian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Greenlian Bunker, welcome, my friends, to another week of weirdness. You know what time it is. Welcome to the Mohorovic discontinuity, that dark disquiet that exists within the hollow earth, and I, my friends, am your one and only mouth of the south. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Greenlian Report. Thank you for joining us live, those of you who are live listeners out there, and the rest of you who are downloading the downloadable podcast. Highly downloadable. Highly doable. A doable download. But I digress. Before I digress anymore on doable downloads, the man across the master console from me here, producer, co-host, Mr. Chris Hayes. Welcome to the program, Chris. How are you?
I am so good. I'm so good.
Oh, quit bragging, sexy. Look at this guy. Mr. Sexy Pants over here.
No, no, you know, kind eyes. Kind eyes.
I was talking about you.
I've got sexy pants. I'm actually wearing my sexy pants tonight. Sorry.
The man with the kind eyes also joins us in studio. We're always happy to have him, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Matt, how are you?
I tell you what, I am absolutely mediocre this evening. So.
Absolutely mediocre. You know, tonight we're going to have some incredible stuff going on. We have Thomas Stryker, Ph.D. He is the author of Extraplanetary Experiences, Alien-Human Contact, and the Expansion of Consciousness. We're also going to be talking with a few others tonight on the program. In fact, we're going to be talking with a special mystery guest here in just a moment. And I want to get to some hijinks that's been going on in the UFO community. Okay? Let me just tell you, in the UFO community lately, there has been some interesting stuff going on. For one, over at the Intrepid Mag blog, for weeks we've been talking about a series of interesting photographs that were taken over Castle Rock, Colorado. Okay? I think, thanks to not only those here present in this studio and the fine folks over at Intrepid Magazine, like Scotty Robertson, well, of course, I'm one of the fine folks over at Intrepid Magazine, but also our listeners who are highly involved in this program, and who are highly involved in the goings-on in the UFO community. We've got listeners of this program who've helped out with things. We've also got, of course, people who are readers. We've got readers of Intrepid Magazine who have assisted, and I think we've actually figured out what is going on, okay, with the Castle Rock UFO. I'm sure that folks out there say, well, you know, these things are probably plasmas, or maybe these are just pixels, you know, dead pixels on a camera. I know that was what the above top secret forums had to say about it recently, that these were some sort of a dead pixel phenomena. I'll tell you, we've figured out, without, I think, any shadow of a doubt, what is actually going on with the Castle Rock photographs. I think we know conclusively what's going on.
Do you have conclusive proof?
Conclusive proof. But I'll tell you this. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to get the word out precisely with regard to what has been going on because of a series of hijinks that has taken place this week. Our good friends at the news site, The Anomalist, they were very kind. They went and they actually, we were the front page story. The Greenlian Report was the top story for July 23rd. They weren't airplanes. Curious new information on Colorado UFO case surfaces. So if you're listening to this, go on over. Head on over to the Greenlian Report website. That's GRAELIENReport.com. Check it out. We've got the story right there, which actually, I've got a little commentary there, but really that's going to link you over to the Intrepid Mag blog, where we've got the entire rundown as to what this actually is, because one of the Intrepid Magazine readers is who actually helped us figure this out. Okay? I think we've figured out that there was some sort of a photographic anomaly going on. And when you do real serious UFO investigation, this is what has to happen. Okay? You have to go into it with an open mind and say, okay, we don't know what we're dealing with, but we're going to try and get to the bottom of it, no matter what the phenomenon underlying, okay, may end up being. So that said, I think we've figured this out. And yes, the Anomalists were kind enough to make this the top story yesterday for July 23rd, but, and I'm sure this was a mistake, because we're friends with the folks over at Anomalous. But I have to say, Anomalous.com, there was an error. When you click on the story, it says right there at the top of the page, they weren't airplanes. Curious new information on Colorado UFO case surfaces. Now, I had sent them an email with a link to the article at Intrepid Mag's blog, because that really gave the entire story about what we'd figured out and how we had solved this perplexing UFO light show that had gone on over Castle Rock, Colorado. But when you click on the link over there at anomalous.com, here's what ends up happening. It takes you to the above top secret forums who linked to the article. And they had some of the photographs up there just as well. So I thought, well, dang, I'm just going to scroll down and hopefully at least, you know, they linked there at the above top secret website. Maybe they linked to one of the articles and they said, see the article here. And then when you click the link, sure enough, it takes you to the Who Forted blog. Our good friend Greg Newkirk, he's one of our field correspondents here on the program, in fact. He's a great guy, and he was nice enough to do a write-up on that article for us at the Who Forted blog. But that's who Above Top Secret linked to. And then finally, at the very bottom of the page, it said, oh, and you can see more photos here, and then they linked to the Intrepid blog. So I'm looking at all this thinking, wow, and it's not about getting the Grailian report linked. I just want to make sure that the accurate information is getting to the right avenues and that people are really paying attention to it. Well, late in the day, the Anomalist actually comes and they update the article and they say, update! And I'm thinking, oh, hallelujah, here it is, we've got the update. Update, it appears a very logical explanation exists for these photos. Well, thank you! That's what we've been saying all along! Our correspondent writes, all professional grades of Nikon cameras allow the operator to enable or disable hot pixel subtraction for long exposures. I strongly suspect this feature was turned off, leading to a classic hot pixel contaminated image as explained, and then they have a link embedded within the word here. You follow the link and it takes you back to the above top secret forums. And I'm a little dismayed. Joining us live right now from New Richmond, Wisconsin, Mr. Scotty Roberts on the program. Scotty, how are you tonight?
Scott. Hey, Micah, I'm doing great. How you doing?
Doing fantastic. You know, thanks for coming on the program at the last minute. It's not like, you know, my listeners know that you and I are friends or anything.
Yeah, that's right.
But, so you've heard this whole story now as this has unfolded. I'm a little dismayed that, and granted, you know, I'm not picking on the Anomalist. The Anomalist, they're our friends. But I'm a little dismayed only at the fact that the information, I think over at the Intrepid Mag blog right now, if people want to go over there and look, we've figured this thing out. We've got it all broken down. As a matter of fact, I've had some flight specialists and some engineering folks and people who are really probably better at this thing, you know, finding this kind of information than myself, who have helped to determine surely that we weren't looking at aircraft. And then a photographic analyst who is a reader of Intrepid Magazine who came to the blog offered to do this work for us and managed to, I think, pretty conclusively figure this out. And yet,
I think he's got it figured out. Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty clear. And we've, you know, granted, we're not people who go into this trying to debunk it. We're just looking for the truth. And what we have managed to find is, well, that this is not some sort of a strange aerial phenomenon. This was a photographic anomaly. But it wasn't hot pixels. And yet, this is the information that gets updated over at the Anomalist website, and I'm just a bit dismayed that, you know, whoever it is linking the articles, no matter how great your intentions are, we just want the right information to get out there. We've already figured this out, and people are still talking about hot pixels. There's some people out there still saying these things are mothership from Zeta 2 Reticuli. You know?
Well, you know, and I also think it's probably a really good thing that they put it up there, and they put it out there once again for discussion. What the Anomalous has done by putting this up is, without the conclusions that we have found out and reached, it's allowing a whole other group of people to come in there and start questioning this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fun to sit back and watch that now that we've figured it out and see what everybody else has to say. As far as hot pixels, first time I saw that phrase come up in one of the responses on our blog was, now, come on. You know, you can debunk all you want, but debunk within the framework of being accurate. That is not what hot pixels look like, and hot pixels don't line up like that.
You know, these people probably also don't know, for instance, that not only is the gentleman who took these photographs, Greg Archer, a very accomplished photographer. He didn't come into this saying, okay, this is some sort of a, you know, an instance of extraterrestrial aircraft from another planet. He said, look, these things are UFOs by definition. I don't know what they are. I'm trying to debunk them. If you can do it, and if you can succeed where I have failed, more power to you, because that's what we're trying to do. I've taken these photos. We don't know what they are. Let's get to the bottom of this. And we have. And Greg, the photographer, accepted that himself, and he has graciously done so. I have to commend the guy for coming into this, not knowing what we were dealing with, and then once the explanation that we've put out in the blog post at intrepidmag.com, you know, once we put this information out there, he said, you know what? You're absolutely right. That's got to be the solution to this. Okay, I admit where I was wrong. But Greg is nonetheless a very good photographer, and he also addressed the hot pixel question and said, look, I can tell you right now, I know enough about the operation of my camera to know what I'm dealing with. These are not hot pixels. And I think he's right. In fact, we know he's right. We know it was something else. It was actually a variation of lens refraction. And I'll tell you, Scotty, as I'm sure that you feel too, what I've learned from this is that the the way that people attach themselves to belief, whether it be belief in the lack thereof, as the, you know, the pseudo-skeptic debunkers do, or if it's, you know, the people who just want so badly to believe we're being visited, belief trumps everything when it comes to a controversial set of photographs, which are purported to be UFOs or anything else for that matter. I mean, it's absolutely mind-numbing and just incredible to me the way that people have reacted to this.
Well, absolutely. And I look at this photograph and I put the whole thing not even into the category of controversial. This isn't controversial to me. All it was a photograph that had lights in it that the photographer didn't know what it was. And so he put it out there and said, I tested it on several different levels, ran it through a couple of mental tests, a couple of tests of things that I know how they work, kind of tests. And it wasn't controversial. It wasn't a controversial photo. It was an interesting photo. It was a photo that had lights that were unexplainable at first. When you looked at it, that does not by itself make that thing a controversial photo. What is controversial about any of this is what you just said, the belief systems that people bring to it. That creates the controversy. The photograph itself, in enough time, as we saw, you figure it out. You can figure out what it is. You run it through things. I don't even like the term of debunking the thing. I don't think it needed to be debunked because nobody was making a claim with it. There was nothing to debunk. What there was a series of experiments, if you will, or examination to determine what exactly was in the photo. That doesn't make the photo controversial, nor does it make the topic or the subject matter of the photograph something that was in need of debunking. Why did it need to be debunked? Nobody was making a claim.
I think that's it right there, though, Scotty, is that, you know, there are people who go into this, saying, well, I'm going to debunk it, or, no, you can't debunk it because we know obviously what this is already. And what I invite people to do is the original article that we've got linked over there at the Intrepid Mag blog, scroll down and read those comments. I mean, we did that here on the show.
If you have an extra hour. Yeah.
There's a lot of them. There's probably more than 150 comments there. People just going back and forth. And some of these people are like, oh, you idiots, it's ball lightning, duh. And what's so funny is, again, we have figured out precisely, scientifically, okay, mechanically, what was going on there, thanks to the help of one of the Intrepid blog readers. We know. Yeah, we know what was going on. And the thing is that I love still looking back with the certainty that these people had at their commentary on the various different potentials involved, which it ended up being none of those things, but these people were certain of it.
Come on, Mike. Obviously, that's obvious. It's nothing else but ball lightning. Why, that's ball lightning. Yeah. And all I had to do is look at that and go, have you ever seen ball lightning? Have you ever seen a good picture of ball lightning? Have you ever seen ball lightning line up in a straight row with 13 of them? Oh, right. You haven't? What makes that ball lightning, and why are you so damn sure about it? That's the kind of thing I don't like about debunkers or skeptics of that nature, is that they come in and they are, as, if you will, dogmatic and theological about their approach as is faith or religion, mm-hmm. or believers. I think the biggest religious group out there are skeptics and academia.
They're certainly one of the best out there. So, well, folks, all I can tell you is it's a bit dismaying that indeed we figured this out, I think, and maybe the information somehow by virtue of a you know, I guess it was a fluke, but it didn't get to the news sources. And I hope to email everybody and tell them, listen, by the way, You didn't link to the Grail Alien Report. You didn't link to the Intrepid Mag website, and that's okay. At least the story got out there, but we have figured it out. And if you do go over to the Intrepid Mag blog, we've got this all worked out, and I think that people conclusively will be able to look at this series of photographs and go, oh, yeah, that's what that is. It's intrepidmag.com/blog. Go check it out. And Scotty, before we let you go, by the way, because I know you're a busy man, you're working on a book right now. You're about to finish another book. Can we talk about that?
Sure, we can talk about it. Yes, I have been actually sequestered in the local hotel in my hometown here, just trying to find peace and quiet to finish up this book. And I hope nobody interprets that as I've abandoned my family for the week. I'm only 5 minutes from home here, but I have holed up in the local Kasbah in order to find a little non-interrupted time, so I can finish this book, which has to be into the publisher early next week. And so I have been hard at it.
You got to love those deadlines. You got to love those deadlines. Well, Scotty, keep up the good work. I know you're always working hard. And, of course, as you and I both know, being the organizers of this event, tickets are still selling to Paradigm Symposium. You know, in the midst of all this other UFO craziness and writing books and everything else going on, you know, I've been in the bunker all day, and I'm probably not really in my right mind. But we've got Paradigm Symposium going on in the midst of all that just as well. So it's an exciting time, folks. And Scotty, it's always exciting when you join us here on the Grail Alien Report. My dear friend, comrade, thank you so much for being on the program.
Keep up the good work, science officer.
Of course. Yes, I am his science officer, and I'll gladly call that gentleman captain. Good night, Scotty. And when we come back from this break, we're going to get to a few listener emails, and I'm just going to be straight up and honest with you. I saw a UFO last night, and damned if I know what this thing was. It was probably the strangest thing I have ever seen in my life, at least in terms of aerial phenomena. And when we come back from this break, I'm going to tell you about a UFO that I saw over Asheville, North Carolina. And what's even stranger about this is there are so many peculiar tie-ins in the field of ufology in terms of what can happen and maybe the potential that people manifest certain things. Well, this one gets pretty weird, aside from the physical nature of the phenomenon itself. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be back here on the Grail Alien Report. Are you an author or maybe someone who wants to write books for a living? You know, self-publishing is one of the most exciting areas in the publishing world today. The reach of the internet has made the world, well, a little smaller, and just about anyone can pursue their dreams of writing and selling their work to a readership worldwide. But when you finish writing your book, part of what sells your words is having a great-looking cover. And that's why I highly recommend Green Alien Art, featuring the work of Rick Green, one of the finest graphic artists out there, who specializes in book covers, trailers, and graphic art that will help bring your written work to life. If you're considering self-publishing, make sure your work looks the best that it can. Green Alien Art will help you do it. Online at greenalienart.com. From the dark heart of the Moho, welcome back, my friends. It is the Grail Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks, your host. Just wrapping up our conversation with Scotty Roberts. That was an impromptu conversation. He actually called me right before we took the air, and I said, Scotty, you know, with this stuff going on over at the Intrepid blog, it'd be good to talk to you. Oh, yeah, and by the way, I do want to point out, we've got some new bumper music there. That's the fine talent of DJ Transhuman, otherwise known as Caleb Hanks. He's also one of our field correspondents, and he's a very, very talented musician. Always glad to have his tunes featured here on the program. Stick around, because during the second hour of tonight's broadcast, we will be talking with Thomas James Stryker, Ph.D., about his book Extraplanetary Experiences, Alien-Human Contact and the Expansion of Consciousness. I also spoke with Kingsley Dennis, author of The Struggle for Your Mind, earlier today. We're going to be having him on the program in the coming weeks, and I'll tell you, Kingsley is just a fantastic guy. He's going to be someone you're going to be hearing from a lot more on this program in the future. But we're going to be having Kingsley on in the next few weeks as a guest here on the program just as well. But before we move much further along, you know, we kicked off the show with this story about UFOs over Castle Rock, Colorado, which really, in truth, were not UFOs. They weren't even unidentified flying objects. They were merely a photographic anomaly. But I tell you, it's really fascinating to see how we figured this one out. It took a few weeks. It took a lot of, you know, brilliant minds and live bodies who were willing to dig through air traffic control data that was released into the public domain, weather information from the weather stations there in the Denver area. We also managed to get photographic analysts, Scotty Roberts being one of them, being a professional photographer and an all-around artiste. And after all the hard work and comparing notes, we did manage to get to the bottom of this and figure out that these were not objects seen in the sky, even to the satisfaction of the photographer himself. So it's been fascinating, and again, you know, we're going to do our best to get this information out to people. And you know what? You can help us do that, in fact. No man is an island, but we have, fortunately, an army of listeners out there, loyal listeners who write emails that I'm about to read, in fact, here on the program. And if you'd like to help us with the Graylian Report, here's what you can do. Email your favorite paranormal news outlets and tell them, check out what these guys are doing. Help us out. Help us get the word out. If you've got a paranormal blog or a blog of any kind, for that matter, or a website, you know, you can link us, www.graylianreport.com. Link us to your website. As a matter of fact, contact us at info@graylianreport.com. Maybe we can work out a link exchange. We love to do that. If you're an active blogger and you're a researcher of the unexplained, you know, don't think that there's got to be a barrier there. It's all about openness, connection, communication, cosmic love. I think those things are the very things, that very essence that culminates to form what I call cosmic love. Openness, you know, esoteric enlightenment, and connection with others. So make that connection with us, info@graylianreport.com. We'd be happy to work out a link exchange with you. And then finally, of course, if you're over at the website, www.graylianreport.com, there's a donate button, a PayPal donate button right there at the top of the page. We encourage you heartily, if you will, if you would like to, if the spirit so moves you, to make a donation to our operation, help us out. That's always something that's helpful just as well. But if you haven't got dollars, you know, if you haven't got a website, there are other ways you can help just as well. In fact, you know, listener emails are some of our very favorite ways that people can get involved. And David wrote recently to say, my name is David and I live in Portland, Oregon. And he said, thanks to Coast AM, I stumbled across the image of those glowing orbs in the thunderstorm over Castle Rock. Now, we've determined at this point what those things were, but get this. David says, I just wanted to say that the image is most likely fully legit, and here was the reason that he... Now, this was, of course, written before we figured out what was going on, but what David had to say was that I saw the exact same thing as what those images show, but on a perfectly clear night on July 4th, 2012, at around 10 after 10 o'clock, maybe between 10:10 and 10:30. I was sitting on the river in downtown Portland. There were three red-orange glowing orbs up front in a triangle formation, followed by six or seven, just like the image seems to show. I'm not the only one who saw these orbs. I was with at least 20 other people who all saw these things flying through the sky. Apparently, the whole world has seen them, and at roughly the same time, on the roughly the same day. There were indeed a lot of stories, but granted, we have to take into consideration one key fact here. This was July 4th, so I'm sure a lot of people were seeing strange things in the night sky on the 4th of July. Not to discredit what David writes and describes seeing here, but he did say, I think it's amazing that so many people saw these orbs, which I witnessed. I hope maybe it means something important. What could that mean? You know, I think it's always difficult to discern whether or not there is something truly anomalous going on when you have that in conjunction with, you know, a major holiday where people light fireworks and shoot little flaming balls of light up into the sky. You know, that does make things different and a little difficult. Last week we were talking about a different kind of flaming ball of light, the green fireball phenomenon often associated with UFO encounters. And I put it out to the listeners. I said, if you have seen a green fireball, why don't you write and tell us what you've seen. We'd love to hear your own stories about encounters with green fireballs and similar UFO phenomena. Paul writes, I witnessed a green fireball from Lucia's Lodge located in the southern portion of Big Sur, California in early August of 1999. It was about 12:30 a.m. on a clear night. I was looking south at the stars when the bright green fireball fell from the sky. It was fragmenting as it fell, and some sparks of the fragmenting green fireball were white and yellow. It appeared to fall more slowly than the typical shooting star. It lasted about 4 seconds. My interpretation was that it was space debris entering the atmosphere. The green fireball did not reach the surface of the Pacific, but it appeared to burn out high in the atmosphere, and there was no sound. I ruled out fireworks or flares, as the altitude appeared to be much too high, and the angle from which it appeared was not typical of a firework. I'm a technical writer for a major defense contractor and have military experience with naval missile and gun radar fire control systems. I have a not very exciting story about anomalous radar sightings in the Persian Gulf, but you asked about green fireballs. I enjoy your podcasts. More later, Paul. Well, Paul, if you're listening, we'd love to hear about that not very exciting story, as you term it, about anomalous radar sightings in the Persian Gulf. Because that's another one of those interesting aspects of the greater UFO mysteries, that often people will claim these things appear on radars and then you don't see anything in real life. You don't see anything with the naked eye flying through the sky. And there are a lot of things that can trigger that sort of an incident. You know, odd weather formations and things like that sometimes can do it. There are a lot of things that need to be taken into consideration. Matt, have you ever seen what you would call a UFO? I think I've probably asked you this 100 times, but, you know, for the listener's sake, let's talk about it for a minute. Have you ever seen what you would call a UFO?
I have, on the Blue Ridge Parkway, several years ago, probably 5-6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to say that it did appear in the traditional triangle-shaped batch of lights.
Mm-hmm.
They almost looked like an orange or a red.
Yeah.
Kind of. And just doing weird formations in the sky, not like figure eights, but very fast circles, very quick movements, you know, in regards to where I was sitting on the parkway.
I remember you telling me about this, yeah.
Yeah, from like one side of my windshield to the other, which is obviously a great distance, you know, when you're way farther up in the sky and way farther away than
I
was sitting.
On the Blue Ridge Parkway, overlooking, you know, the mountainscape in the distance, I mean, we're talking about like horizon to horizon here, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this light apparently was moving from one end of the horizon to another and doing all kinds of erratic, incredibly fast maneuvering.
And then took off to the right side of my car, mm-hmm. Right side of the window, and then just took off behind me and didn't see it after that.
Wow.
The whole thing lasted probably 2 minutes tops. Mm.
You know, I hear so many stories like that. There was a gentleman who told me he was lying in bed late one night. This gentleman had actually had a previous encounter where he had said that when he was about... it's very interesting. His name was James, and he said, you know, this took place right around the same time as the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember President Kennedy's address, and I remember everything that was going on, and that's what made this event so significant in my own mind. And he said that my friends and I, we were about 10 years old, living in Florida at the time, and I remember, and James, he looked at me and he started rubbing his arms up and down like this, and he says, we were doing this, because the hair on our arms was standing up, it felt tickly, you know, almost like an electrostatic kind of phenomenon. And he said that at that moment, one of us looked up, and there was a horseshoe-shaped object hovering at an altitude. It wasn't really, really high up, but it was high up enough to where we couldn't make out really all the fine details. We could see that it was metallic. There was a red globe of light around the front, and then there were two smaller globes on either side, one red, one green. And that this object, these lights were oriented where the little smaller red and green globes that seemed to come down off the base of the craft were oriented along, I guess what you'd call the arms of the horseshoe, and then right at the center of the U was the large red light. And he said it was a horseshoe-shaped object, and this thing was there hovering in the sky. And yeah, sure enough, it made the hair on our arms stand up, but not like we were scared. It was like static electricity. And then, as we stood there watching it, this thing just vanished. Boom. And I said, James, did it fly off at an incredible speed, or did it literally disappear? And he said, you know, that we don't recall. We just remember it was there 1 minute, and then the next it was completely gone. Where did it go? So James had had that experience when he was a young man. Of course, his young friends who had been there with him, had seen this as well and always attested to what they'd seen. Many, many decades later, lying in bed one night, he was looking out his open window, and James said that he saw a white light traveling along. What our friend John Anderson has rather humorously called, Chris, of course, the NFT phenomenon. Non-flashy things. Now, a lot of these can be satellites and the like, but I know that James said that he was lying there in bed watching this thing, and that this object, as it traveled along, it was moving along slowly, and he was just watching it because it was moving through the sky. Thought maybe, you know, same thing. Maybe it was some sort of a satellite. And then all of a sudden, the object stops dead in the sky, stops moving, travels backward along the same path that it had been traveling at an incredible rate of speed. And then he said it goes forward again, and this time it travels so quickly that, and this was where it became a little difficult for James to describe. He said, the craft moves forward at such an incredible speed and disappears that it leaves a light trail as though it had this is incredible. He said it was as though that it outrun the light trail that it had been leaving. This craft moved so quickly that he said it was like the light trail didn't appear until the thing was out of the picture and then appeared. Who knows what was going on there? But he said, I witnessed this with my two eyes lying there in bed that night. Don't have any clue what that was, but I have a real hard time believing that what I saw was any kind of technology that we have yet harnessed and developed here, technically, mechanically, or otherwise, here on Earth. Chris, have you ever seen what you would deem a UFO before?
Never.
You've never seen a UFO?
No. I've looked on a constant basis, really. I mean, every day after the show, we travel the miles all the way back up to the surface and stare at the stars for hours, whether I want to or not, and nothing.
It's perplexing how many people I've known in this world who have gone about trying to find these sorts of things and see these things. They hope for this experience. They're fascinated with UFOs. You know, Travis Walton, only a few weeks before his alleged abduction, that became the basis for the story Fire in the Sky. Well, Travis Walton had said that he had always wanted to see a UFO, and he and his brother had made a pact with one another that said, you know, if one of us ever has an opportunity to get close to a UFO, let's make an agreement right now. We'll get as close to that thing as we possibly can. And, of course, we saw that, you know, how that ended up turning out for Travis when he actually put that in action. Now, as I'd said, last night I had a bit of an experience of my own, and it's not uncommon, I don't think, for talk radio hosts to have these sorts of experiences where they see strange things. My friend Joshua Warren had described seeing some strange things while out in the desert, viewing night vision, or viewing alleged UFOs using night vision, along with our good friend, a dear friend of the program, and a guy who I probably would dress up like Santa Claus on Christmas and sit in his lap, Ed Grimsley. But Joshua claimed to have seen lights with Grimsley while out in the deserts of the Southwest.
Were they wearing their third-generation night vision goggles?
They were using night vision goggles with Grimsley that night, you know.
Okay. Well.
And I'll tell you, I mean, my most recent experience with Ed Grimsley, Scotty Roberts, Dr. Rita Louise, and myself, we were out there in a parking lot in Sacramento, California with Ed Grimsley. And there had actually been a sketchy character following Ed around, and I felt sorry for him, so I told him I'll come over here with you because I don't want, you know, I know when you got Ed on the watch, it's a little difficult to find anybody who's really more sketchy looking, but this guy even outsketched Grimsley. And so I said, well, Ed, I'll come over there with you. And so we went over there together, and I got Scotty and Rita to come along, and I said, you know, if you guys haven't experienced this, this is kind of fun. You know, Ed's, you know, he's invested a lot of money, and he really does know inside and out how to work these night vision goggles. So, you know, let's go over here. And so Ed took us out, and yeah, you see all kinds of things in the sky, but there are night birds, there are bats, there are satellites, there are aircraft. And then there's this video that showed up recently, okay? As a matter of fact, Ben McGee, who's one of the stars of the new program Chasing UFOs on National Geographic, commented on this video because it was so perplexing. It appears to show three lights traveling in formation in the American Southwest. They were filmed by a paranormal investigation group who said that this object, whatever it was invisible to the naked eye, but then when viewed through night vision, they were able to see it. And Ben McGee says, yeah, I'll tell you exactly what that is. That is a Border Patrol drone. And some of these drones, okay, are actually fitted with infrared lighting so that they are invisible to the naked eye, but so that people who are Border Patrol officers can see exactly where these drones are at all times. And that's what this video shows. So there are occasionally things that are seen in the skies that are conventional, but more or less unknown to the public, and nonetheless, which can appear very, very anomalous, especially if viewed through, you know, third-generation night vision goggles or the like. And so, I know that Joshua claimed to have seen, you know, 3 points of light traveling like that at a, you know, decent altitude over the American Southwest in the desert one night with Grimsley. Maybe he saw one of these drones as well. I know that Art Bell many years ago claimed that he and his late wife Ramona had seen a large triangular UFO, and they saw that with their naked eyes. And this was the classic experience with a great big dark black silent triangle flying noiselessly over the desert. You know, there have been a lot of people who have claimed that they've had these experiences and seen these sorts of things. And then, of course, I think it was last year there was the British journalist who called into the morning radio program and talked about rather, well, he wasn't really comfortable using the expression, but he said, I dread saying it, but it was a saucer-shaped craft covered in lights around the perimeter, and this thing flew directly over me as I was traveling along a country road headed to the airport at about 5:30 in the morning local time. What did he see? What was that? You know, there are a lot of people in media who see these sorts of things, and so maybe I'm no different. And yes, indeed, last night I did see something rather inexplicable, and I'd like to put this out to the listeners, as we always do. If you're listening to the program, if you have information, whether you're in the Western North Carolina area or not, we would always welcome that. We always welcome perspectives and ideas, and with that, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go ahead and tell you what I saw, and I'll leave it to your own determination as to what this might actually have been. And I'll explain to the very best of my ability, being, I think, probably a better trained witness to a UFO-type phenomenon than most. I'd like to think so, at least. I was traveling along Brevard Road, just outside of Asheville, actually closer to the area known as West Asheville. And I was coming along, heading toward Interstate 26, just beside Jim Barkley Toyota, a car dealership adjacent to the interstate. And I'm getting on the interstate, headed north along Interstate 26 toward the I-26, I-40 junction. It was 10:22 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. Completely dark outside. The moon had begun to rise off in the distance, but that was to the west of where I was. As I was pulling onto the on-ramp that would take me onto I-26, to the north, maybe slightly northwest, I could see a very brilliant white-orange light. Very brilliant, very large. This was the largest object in the sky because the moon hadn't risen to a point where it was much higher than just above the horizon at this point. And being a crescent moon, it was very easy to determine which light the moon was. This was off next to the horizon, whereas this, whatever this thing was very high in the sky. Okay, not necessarily at a very high altitude, but high in the sky. And the craft was incredibly bright. So immediately, after especially all this research into the nature of what these lights over Colorado might have been over the last 2 weeks, initially what I immediately think is, well, that airplane's coming in for a landing, but those landing lights, something about it did look kind of off. And so I thought, you know, against my better judgment, I will keep an eye on this as I'm coming in and I'm getting down here and I'm headed north along I-26. I'll just keep an eye on it as I'm driving. Now, fortunately, there weren't a lot of other cars on the road at the time. Again, it was about 10:23 p.m. Not a lot of cars on the road, and so I'm driving along, and I'm able to watch this object pretty continuously as I'm driving along. But as I'm driving along, as I'm seeing this craft, I'm realizing that as I get around beside it, the object is still not moving. The object is still not moving once I get around beside this craft, whatever it is. And as I'm moving along, I get along beside this thing. Now, if it had been moving in the direction opposite to that which I'm traveling, I'm headed north at this point toward, I mean, literally directly a few thousand feet in front of me or so, the Interstate 40 junction is right there, the ramp that leads off of I-26 onto Interstate 40. And I'm looking into the sky. If this thing had been moving in the opposite direction, it should have just whizzed right by me. But this object was just hanging there, and I'm looking at it as I'm traveling along beside it, at this point thinking, that thing is hovering, whatever it is, and it is very bright. But it wasn't continuously just a large white-orange light. What this object is, as I get around, the light appears to be fitted on what would have been the front of this object. As I get around beside the craft, there are bluish lights, there are red lights, and then there is a white blinking light, which, again, sounds a lot like an airplane. And so I thought, oh, okay, it's a helicopter then. It's a helicopter, surely. But then I thought, well, if it's a helicopter, I should be able to hear it very easily, and I'll just jump out of my car, and I'm going to take a look at this thing. So I did. I pulled off to the side of the road right there on the exit ramp onto the Interstate 40. Okay. And I turn on my emergency flashers, get out of the car, and I look at this thing. And at this point, it's still kind of hovering. There weren't many cars on the road, and there's no sound of a helicopter, but this thing wasn't at a really extreme altitude. It was, you know, several hundred feet, not really, really, really high in the sky, and it was off a little distance away from, you know, the interstate, so it was kind of over some trees adjacent to the interstate. And as I'm looking at this thing, it starts to very slowly drift off to the south and move silently toward the south. But the general shape, I'm not going to exaggerate this to you, the general shape, and this is what's possibly the most perplexing thing about this to me, the general shape was like an airplane. It did look a lot like an airplane. I couldn't actually see the craft. I could only see the lights, and maybe the light orientation gave the impression of this thing being more or less shaped like an airplane. But it was not moving like an airplane. I've never seen an airplane hover in midair. And then as this thing, as I got out of the car, it's almost as though it realized I was watching, and this thing starts to move very slowly, drifting along, adjacent to the interstate, but not directly above it, and heading south, roughly following the path of Interstate 26, headed toward the Asheville Regional Airport, and then toward Hendersonville on beyond that. And I'm looking at this thing thinking, God, how is it moving so slowly? That's not an airplane. What is going on here? And when it's out of view, I get back in my car, I continue along the ramp, get on Interstate 40, and take immediately the very next exit, which is the Western North Carolina Farmers Market exit. I take that exit, which puts me back up on Brevard Road again. I hang a left, and I retrace my steps, and I go all the way back down Brevard Road, back down to where I'd initially gotten on the interstate again. I still don't see this object. I continue on even further beyond that, and I go all the way down. There's a shopping mall down there, and I park in the shopping mall parking lot, and I look off toward the south trying to see if I can see any lights, and at this point, of course, I can't see anything. So I called my brother. And I thought, I'll just tell somebody about what I've seen here. And what's interesting about this is that my brother, years ago, had called me and had said he had seen an object when traveling right by the Western North Carolina Farmers Market. And he'd said that there was a large light in the sky. This thing appeared to be maybe kind of triangular. It had been hovering, and then it began to drift off slowly. He'd seen it right there in the same locale. And longtime listeners of this program may find this somewhat familiar, because I'll tell you what. The same sort of object was seen in that very same location years ago by one of our field correspondents, Tyler Pittman, who covered the release of the West Memphis Three last summer here on the program. So I'll tell you, we got a double shot there with Tyler when he was on the program, because he, of course, had been there live when the release of Damien Echols and the others associated with the Robin Hood Hills murders many, many years ago. Many believe, most in fact believe, that they were wrongly accused of those crimes. These men were released from prison, and Tyler was there on hand, and he was doing citizen journalism, taking very good photographs there at the release. But he'd also had this UFO experience, and so we had him stay on the program and talk about the UFO he'd seen. And this was exactly the same sort of thing. He'd been traveling northbound along I-26, coming back from Hendersonville. He had seen a bright light in the distance ahead up in the sky. Very, very bright light. And then as he gets up on this thing, he says, I literally get to the junction between I-26 and I-40, and right there where the two split from one another, he says, I park my car, my truck. I couldn't get out immediately, but this object, whatever it was directly above me. It was triangle-shaped. It had red and blue lights on it. And he said, I had to wait because there was a great big 18-wheeler that was coming directly up from behind and to my left beside me. As soon as I could get out of the car, I was fumbling trying to get my camera phone and get my camera setting on my phone rather so that I could try and take a picture of this craft. And it had begun to drift away, and it managed to get out of there and head over to the trees adjacent to the interstate there and get over those, or get behind those trees, so that I couldn't photograph it. Almost identical to what I had happened last night. And so what I have to wonder is, what in the world, what kind of aircraft this was. This was obviously a physical aircraft. It had a flashing white light on it, just like an airplane, but it was hovering. It was much smaller. Like Tyler described, this object looked like it was maybe about the size of a large automobile. This was not the size of an airplane, a commercial aircraft at least. I thought about maybe a hobby aircraft, but that bright light on the front, I've never seen hobby aircraft, you know, remote-controlled airplanes that behaved quite like that, or that had a light that bright. So I don't know what it was. The best I could probably determine is that maybe what we were looking at was some sort of a drone. And we keep hearing about these drones. In fact, drones have made the cover of Wired Magazine this month. I'm pretty perplexed. I don't know what that was. But based on that description, if you, one of our dear listeners, have any more information, you're welcome to email us, info@graylianreport.com. We'd love to hear what you have to say. And hopefully you'll stick around to hear what we have to say in the final minutes of this hour. We'll wrap things up when we come back from this break here on the Graylian Report. Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report here. Today I want to talk to you about Intrepid Magazine, the new leader in clear and reasoned thinking in an unpredictable world, and the official magazine of the Graylian Report. Intrepid features the latest in-depth analysis of science, culture, conspiracy, politics, and unexplained phenomena. You'll get expert commentary from an incredible cast of seasoned writers and researchers, as well as interviews and insights from some of the biggest names in the field. And best of all, you can subscribe today for just $14.95. It's Intrepid Magazine. Boldly going. Subscribe today by visiting IntrepidMag.com, and coming soon, look for Intrepid on Nook and Kindle e-readers. Remember, folks, if you want to be an official member of the Fraternal Order of the Fig, you have to try actual Fig Newtons. You can't just stick with strawberry, raspberry, or blueberry. Apple don't count either. You have to actually try Fig Newtons.
Now, if there was a Kiwi Newton, you could try that because that'd be really good.
A Kiwi Newton, huh? Huh. Huh. You know...
I hope you're listening, Nabisco. Kiwi Newtons.
That would be a good idea, wouldn't it? Kiwi Newtons. We came up with that here first on the Graylian Report. So anyway, we talked about all different varieties of UFOs here on the program thus far tonight, whether it be sightings of strange objects seen over Asheville, North Carolina by yours truly, or, well, what appeared to be objects over Castle Rock that later were debunked as being something else. And, yeah, I know Scotty doesn't really like using that term because I think that a debunker is a person who wants to go out, you know. Well, you can debunk something, and if you're doing it honestly, if you say, okay, well, someone claimed this was a ghost or a Bigfoot or a UFO, and we can tell you conclusively that that's not what this is, and, in fact, here's a better, more plausible and logical explanation. There's nothing wrong with that to me. Nothing wrong at all. In fact, that's good. I think that the problem comes into play when we have people who come along and who say, well, you know what? It doesn't matter what that may or may not be. I'm going to find a plausible explanation for it, and I'm going to prove to everyone else that that is not what they say it is, despite what it may actually be. Because there is no such thing as a UFO, nor Bigfoot, nor ghosts. There are no plesiosaurs swimming around in the lock, and we know this conclusively because we adhere to that belief known as science. I think that's the kind of bad debunking, right?
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Hi, this is Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report. Have you heard about the Paradigm Symposium 2012 yet? Well, it's going to be a huge event we're putting on along with Intrepid Magazine up in Minneapolis, Minnesota this October 18th through 21st. But rather than just having me tell you about it, here's George Norrie from Coast to Coast AM. George?
Thanks, Micah. This is George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM inviting you to attend the Paradigm Symposium 2012. If you love UFOs and aliens, lost civilizations, and mysteries of the past, well, this is the event for you. And all you have to do to learn more is visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
The Paradigm Symposium 2012, reviewing our past and changing our future. Check us out online, ParadigmSymposium.com. That website again, ParadigmSymposium.com.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
To all the fiends of Fortiana out there, welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, joined in studio as always by producer Chris Hayes and engineer Matt Oakley. Both of these guys working up a storm tonight. We're always working hard to bring you the latest in the strange, the unusual, the esoteric, and a bit of the mystical as well. You know, I think that, you know, pardon the expression, but I'm going to say in this field you're going to be so bombarded, I think, at times with what we might call paranormal porn, okay? No, not that kind of porn, Matt. I mean, just the kind of stuff, it's like people want this overt, you know, just this full-on meat and potatoes, I saw a Bigfoot, or I saw this, I saw that. I think that sometimes the hidden nature of the esoteric experience, the unusual, the truly unexplained aspects of this life are a lot more, well, they're a lot more subversive. They're a lot less obvious, if you will. The synchronicities and things like that. And in a way, I like to think that on this program, we pride ourselves in gravitating more toward that more tasteful, you know, the more, I don't know, the kind of unusual phenomenon and the esoteric and the paranormal that kind of keeps you guessing and leaves a bit to the imagination, because I think that while there are these full-on hardcore experiences, Sasquatch tromping through the forest, you know, and all this sort of stuff, I think that most often, those are also the more questionable encounters. When somebody shows up claiming they have a physical Bigfoot body in a cooler, how many times has it proven that this person was telling the truth and that, yes, indeed, we had a physical specimen of a Sasquatch?
You remember that one a couple years ago?
Huh?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what you're referring to there?
Well, I mean, I'm talking about any of them. I mean, you know.
Well.
And some people have debated, you know, the Minnesota Iceman and some of these stories and things like that. So I think that the essence of it really is this, that, you know, while sure it'd be great if a Bigfoot came rolling down a bank while a film crew happened to be out there filming a documentary on, you know, wildlife in Yellowstone Park or whatever, while I think it'd be great if you know, a bunch of people doing a photo shoot one evening, you know, at a fancy restaurant on the new terrace or outside doing, you know, late night photography and a UFO just happens to drift over and they get these incredible photographs, we usually are not afforded that, you know, and I think that the more easily overlooked phenomena in our daily life, those kinds of things, I think people are content to just kind of overlook and do without. And every now and then we kind of focus on those sorts of things on this program, the mystical, the esoteric, those things which, you know, cause us to have to think just a little bit about what we're dealing with, and maybe that we can't just look at and say, hey, clearly there is something strange going on here. And I love the challenge of having to think about certain phenomena a bit before we can come to terms with what precisely it is. Now, our guest tonight, Thomas Stryker, obtained his PhD in psychology at Saybrook University in San Francisco, California, his MA degree in transpersonal psychology at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California in 2005, and his BA degree in psychology from California State University, Sacramento. His new book is called Extraplanetary Experiences, Alien-Human Contact and the Expansion of Consciousness. And in it, he studies the universal consistency between people's experiences. Some of these are mystical experiences. Some of these are full-on encounters with alien beings. But all of them seem to involve contact with alien or some sort of an interdimensional presence. Dr. Thomas Stryker, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So glad that you were able to join us. And I tell you, I've really been enjoying your book lately. This is fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
And of course, you know, you were trained under those who study UFO and abduction phenomena know the name John Mack very well. You studied directly under John Mack. So in your research, and we're going to get to John Mack here in a moment as well, but I do want to start off by asking you that with the new book, you speak with people who feel that they've had experiences in other states, specifically having to do with other physical planets and even moons. You've created a term for this, which, of course, is featured in the title of the book. You call it the extraplanetary experience. So what precisely constitutes, and maybe what kinds of people claim to have these sorts of experiences?
Well, you know, I can't really say exactly who has these type of experiences because I've had, you know, the pleasure of listening to quite a few people, about 150 now, from all different walks of life. You know, I guess the most basic way to look at this is, you know, it's a basically an extraplanetary experience, it's abbreviated as XPE, is basically just a reported experience by an individual claiming that they have visited another planet, star system, or moon. And this experience could have been an out-of-body experience also. So it opens up to a large realm. What I'm trying to do is gather information about what these planets are like, what they see. But the basic crux of my study is how this type of experience has affected the person. So what I found out was that it was a tremendous change of life. For instance, one of the first interviews that I have in the book is with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut.
Oh, yeah.
We call the interview the Apollo Samadhi. You know, Edgar is over 80 years old now, and he's still unraveling that experience of what that was like of going to, you know, we're not going to consider a moon a planet, but pretty darn close, you know, another celestial body out there,
mm-hmm.
got out of a spacecraft, walked down there, and came back. So he's still unraveling that, the mystery behind it all. But, you know, the real important part of this, you know, to answer your question, is the changes that took place in these people from their experience.
That seems to be the key consistency. And you know, whether you study the sorts of out-of-body experiences that some of the people in the more paranormal realms have discussed, or maybe you talk about the psychonauts, people who have taken, you know, mystical entheogens and things like that and have actually, you know, evoked this sort of experience chemically. Many people describe very certain consistencies between their experiences. Now, your own work, as we mentioned earlier, in this field was highly influenced by UFO abduction researcher John Mack, MD. So tell us a bit about your relationship with John Mack and how that helped shape your own approach to trying to understand people's experiences with what appeared to be alien-human contact.
Well, basically, when I was at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto trying to obtain my doctorate degree there, I was enrolled in a PhD dissertation phase, so I had to write a dissertation. And if you ever have written a dissertation, it's like writing a book. And basically, they were not going to accept my topic, and my topic at the time was just what the book is about now, you know, people that go to other planets.
Mm-hmm.
They would not accept the topic unless I had an expert. I said to the school, I said, well, who do you consider an expert? And they said, well, if you can get Dr. John Mack on your side, we'll let you do the dissertation here. So I didn't know all that much about, you know, Dr. Mack at the time. I knew he had two books out, you know, Alien Abduction and Passport to the Cosmos, but I never thought I'd be able to work with him. But anyway, to make a long story short, I tried for months working through his secretary, her name was Pat Carr, just begging that, you know, he look at some of my work and possibly be on my dissertation committee. So finally, after a couple of months, the secretary called and said, okay, John Mack is going to call you tonight at your house at about 7 o'clock. Be there, and you can discuss this with him. So 7 o'clock came around. He did call me, and we just it was like a kindling. You know, it was like we really resonated with each other. And he said, yep, I'll do it. I'll send the paperwork in tomorrow. So there it was. That was the start of it. And we worked together for about 6 months, unfortunately. He was hit and killed by a drunk driver in London. Yeah. That ended it all. That ended my dissertation at the school also. So I had to find another school to finish that dissertation, which was unfortunate. But my work with John was incredible. I mean, he was just one of those kind of guys, you know. He was an anomalous person himself, you know, an anomaly. Because he just had an extraordinary way of looking at things. And, you know, besides his professional background, you know, as being a psychiatrist, you know, once you got on another level with him and you start talking about his witnessing technique that he used, you know, with his experiencers and really trying to begin a more discussion with experiencers. He would always call people experiencers, and he would use this term witnessing. Now, that what it came down to, there were some key ingredients to witnessing, and a lot of it was about resonance, sympathetic resonance, really getting into the heart and soul of this person that's giving you this story, you know, and seeing how it affects the listener. And so you really tune in like a tuning fork to your listener to see what's there. And a lot of times, you know, it strikes the right note and you're on your way to really great possibilities with that experiencer, because that experiencer can start, you know, really understanding their own experience a little bit deeper because of a more relaxed kind of atmosphere, and just kind of let the tension and fear and stress go. So I learned a lot from John about that, and I think that was probably the biggest part of John. The other part of John that a lot of people don't know is, like, so, you know, he wrote the book on, you know, alien abductions. Now, that's got a lot of people scared of, I want to call them aliens, I mean, extraterrestrials would be another word, and that's, you know, the alien abduction phenomenon is a whole nother phenomenon. I want, you know, the audience to be clear about that. You know, none of the people that I interviewed in my book had an alien abduction experience. These were people that were invited, or they had a relationship with extraterrestrials. So it's a little bit different there. So, you know, talking about the alien abduction phenomenon would be a whole, you know, a couple hours in itself program if we got into that. So,
well, I'm sure it'd take more than 2 hours, you know?
Yeah.
it's a very, very complex phenomenon, as Mack, you know, outlined in a lot of his work, and as I'm sure that you are familiar with as well. But now, maybe to help kind of, you know, show the differences and identify those differences between what we know as alien abduction, okay, which is often a very terrifying experience, and I'm not convinced that in every instance it's entirely a physical experience either. I think a lot of the experiencers themselves would even tell you that there is a very metaphysical aspect to this. In your research with extraplanetary experiences, indeed, people were claiming to travel to, you know, maybe out of body or otherwise to other locations, and have these kind of, well, I think a lot of the people who describe these things, including Dr. Mitchell, describe them as a peak experience. Now, of course, Dr. Edgar Mitchell was the fifth man to walk on the moon. He was an Apollo-era astronaut, and of course, he's featured prominently in your book. Dr. Stryker, is the peak experience more metaphysical in nature, or is it really similar to what you describe as this extraplanetary experience?
Well, there's a lot of similarities there. You asked a lot of questions there, and I'm going to try to answer them all if I can. I think that the similarities about the extraplanetary experience, let's say if we're going to compare it to the alien abduction experience, I'm just going to make this kind of short about that, is that a lot of people that report alien abduction experiences Through proper assimilation, I use that word a lot, it's a process people go through. It takes years and years to process an event like that, especially a traumatic event. So through assimilation, a lot of those people that initially reported an alien abduction experience end up changing their mind that it wasn't taken by force after they had time to process it all. Hmm. It was like, okay, I was really scared. I was traumatized, and I really wasn't thinking like how I'm thinking now. As they look at it retrospectively, a lot of these experiencers that thought they had an alien abduction experience through years of assimilation came back and said, that was an incredible teaching I just had. I never looked at it like that before. You know, and so it's like having a Zen master or somebody really intelligent, you know, an upper intelligence, just maybe being a little bit more, more assertive, sometimes even aggressive, on how they teach.
Mm-hmm.
So the peak experience for, like, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who is also the founder of the Noetic Sciences out in the San Francisco Bay Area, he's really saying that he doesn't have all the answers. It's a mystery that continues, and he just figures it's going to continue on for, he doesn't really know how long it's going to, if it ever is going to be answered in this lifetime or maybe another lifetime. It's just something that, you know, that's all part of that assimilation process, how he's processing it, new information coming in about the experience and how it's helping him understand it at a higher conscious level. Because, of course, we all change daily. You know, if we're aware of our changes, you know, our consciousness, we're taking on more consciousness, you know, every day. If we're available for it, it's there. You know, more expanded consciousness. And when you talk with Dr. Mitchell, even to this day, he's that kind of guy because he's always trying to learn new things. And you can tell when you talk with him that his consciousness just keeps expanding because he's taking in the information. Still new information that's coming in about the cosmos now and the possibility of there being other inhabited planets out there. You know, he's observing all this, taking it in, and when you do that, the consciousness keeps expanding at the same time. So you got all these, you know, a wider spectrum of consciousness going on, and it's hard to grasp it all at one time, but for these people that have had the extraplanetary experience, it's nonstop. I can just tell you, these people, all my experiences were over 50 years old. They've had experiences of this kind for 30, 40 years. So they had a lot of time to process, or the other word is assimilate, these experiences. And like I said, it doesn't stop. It just continues and gets more and more profound.
Do they continue to have that experience, in other words, an actual repeat occurrence of the experience itself, or in the event that the experience happens, does it open their mind, the actual, in other words, is the event itself sort of an initiation, and then the consciousness expansion continues thereafter?
Well, I think that's a good way to look at it, you know, an initiation process. You know, I talk about that in my book also. In the beginning of the book, I look at the historical records of such people as George Adamski, uh-huh, and Orfeo Angelucci, and these people that have had, you know, that have stated in books that they've gone to other planets in the physical form. So these people, very similar. You know, I give what's called a thematic content analysis, which means I read and reread their process of their experience in their books, and I pull out particular themes that they all had in common. And it was so strange because most of those themes were the same as the ones that I encountered with the new experiences. So I knew I was onto something. And I'm definitely onto something with this, you know, the new term I'm calling extraplanetary experiences. I just hope I can keep with it and, you know, keep adding new experiences.
You know, I'm sure you will. And that said, I want to ask you, you're probably familiar with this. Are you familiar with the 1970 book that was written by the popular spiritualist Swami Prabhupada? It was called Easy Journey to Other Planets. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with that one exactly. I read a lot of Sri Aurobindo, mm-hmm, but not so much of the one you mentioned. So,
you know,
but I want to write that down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That's what I love about interviews like this is I'll get exposed to different titles and books and things like that. There was a book by Jonathan Zapp that was brought to my attention in the middle of an interview recently. So, sure, feel free to write this down. The book's titled Easy Journey to Other Planets. And in the book, Swami Prabhupada actually states that one can attempt to go to any planet he desires, but this is only possible by psychological changes in the mind or by yogic powers. He says, mind is the nucleus of the material body. Anyone who trains the mind to turn from matter to the spiritual form of the Godhead by performance of bhakti yoga can easily attain the kingdom of God in the anti-material sky. He says there is no, or rather, let me reread what I'm saying here. Of this, there is no doubt. And he was very, very devout in his belief that people literally could travel to other planets through practicing meditation and yoga. So I wonder, again, if that is sort of similar to the sorts of experiences that you're talking about in your book. Do you have instances where some of the people you've interviewed have practiced yoga and found this as a viable pathway to this sort of an experience?
Well, yes. You mentioned Prabhupada. Is that who you were talking about?
Yes, I hope.
And from the Vedic text? Are you talking about the Vedic text right now? Were you referring to the Vedic? It sounds like you may have been. I'm not quite certain. But it might be. Yes, I did cover the Vedic text, and you know, I wrote a lot about it from the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. You know, they talked about the vimanas, or the crafts, spacecrafts, and people could go to other planets. So it's in the literature for thousands of years. You know about how, like, advanced yogis, if we're talking about Vedic texts right now, you know, advanced yogis can go to these states in an out-of-body experience and, you know, basically experience these other planets. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's happened with other people. Now we're just calling them out-of-body experiences. It's very similar to what the Vedic texts were talking about, you know, thousands of years ago. But, you know, the big difference is what's happening is, for sure, there's always the out-of-body experience, but there's also a physical dimension to this now. You know, like in the historical accounts, you know, I used in a book starting from the 50s, the 1950s, these people are claiming they went there physically on a physical spacecraft. You know, and so what the other change is happening is now we're seeing people reporting or claiming they're going on in a physical form, but without spacecraft, you know, which is kind of interesting.
Right.
So things are changing, you know, such terms as teleportation, you know, it's like terms we haven't used before, but maybe we've seen it on Star Trek, you know, when Dr. Spock got, beam me up, Scotty, or, you know, whatever, you know, dematerializing, you know, we're all energy, and, you know, just recreating the energy in a different place, you know, our energy, you know, it's like changing the basic form of ourselves down to pure matter and then transporting that to another place.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting what's going on, and I'm not saying that, you know, we're going into Star Wars or into Star Trek or anything, but a lot of those processes are actually being reported on, you know, in scientific studies.
You know, Thomas,
you look up that term, teleportation.
Oh, yeah, and it's almost as though, you know, I've often wondered, for instance, when we hear people talking about ancient aliens, I've often wondered if, rather than visitation in ancient times by aliens in a physical craft to Earth, if people weren't finding ways, metaphysically, if you will, to enter a state or a dimension where they could have that interaction, and we were the initiates, or those who were rather initiating the actual contact. Now, that said, if that were indeed taking place, I also wonder if we won't at some point find technological means of instigating those same sorts of experiences today, and that although we may change what the catalyst for the experience is, it's essentially the same thing that's taking place, and that this is a process that humans have been undergoing maybe for, oh gosh, since time immemorial.
Well, you know, that's a good point. And, you know, if we look at the Earth as being only 4.6 billion years old, which is considered relatively new, you know, to the age of the cosmos, let's say, which is really unknown. I mean, they put a figure on it, but really we don't know the age of it because we don't know where it ends or if it ends.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're still discovering new things out there. So, if you think about that, you know, there's a great possibility that seeing that the Earth was relatively new, that we could have came from other planets. You know, our ancestors could have came from other planets and started here, you know, billions of years ago. So there's a lot to think about. There's a lot of information out there. We're just, like I said, we're trying to grasp it the best we can. And like I said, trying to assimilate it. I'm on a forum right now for this month of July because I received the Author of a Month award for my book.
Oh, good.
So there's a lot of people asking questions about the book. And, you know, one of the topics, you know, I was presenting a number of different topics, at least a dozen different topics, just to give people an example of how eclectic this, you know, this subject can be. I brought in a new topic. I called it Past Lives on Other Planets. Now, that sounds pretty bizarre to, you know, to most people. Like, how could that even be possible? You know, past life, who believes in past lives? But people that do believe in past lives and reincarnation know about this, you know, that they've come from other worlds, which is kind of interesting. You know, so they were going back to that, you know, yogi, Vedic, Tibetan dream yoga, you know, where they study these things, you know, in a way that's relatively new here. You know, so some things here in the U.S. we've only been studying 30, 40 years, when in other countries they've been studying it for thousands of years. So in a lot of ways we're a little behind in the inner work, if you may, the inner work of how we access our inner world, which, you know, is, of course, comparative to our outer world.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. In the West especially.
How do we see the universe, how a person sees the cosmos, has a lot to do with how they see their inner world.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Especially in the West, we have been preoccupied with, you know, the externalization of what we think the universe is and what the cosmos are. And I think that, again, you know, whether it be in ancient times or in other cultures around the world, there have been people who've looked within for answers to those kinds of things. Dr. Stryker, a question I'd like to ask you with regard to that concept is, you know, what can people today learn from having these kinds of experiences, these extraplanetary experiences you write about, and do you feel that more and more of us may begin to start having those as well?
Well, that's a good question. I think, it starts with the inner work. And, you know, I think a good place to start is just trying to understand how the mind works. Like, I use this terrible analogy of the mind being like a drunken monkey. You know, if you don't try to tame that thing, it's just going to be all over the place, and you're never going to go anywhere but in circles. But you really have to bring in some discipline to the mind and let the mind know what you want, and start, you know, setting some boundaries with the mind. And I think that's what meditation is really about, you know, is bringing in, you know, a different context to the mind. You know, besides the relaxation part of it, you're also using rigid discipline. You know, in the beginning, when most people start meditating, they have to, like, concentrate on something. They'll usually say, well, concentrate on the breath, that's all, and try to rid yourself of all other thoughts. Now, that's really difficult for a person, you know, that has that drunken monkey mentality. That takes years for a lot of people. So it's a long process, but it always pays off for people in the long run. You know, meditation and yoga, especially kundalini-type yoga, and, you know, these different aspects of how we go within ourselves. Another technique I was using that's very simple and everybody has access to usually is a bathtub. You know, using that as a deep relaxation technique, you know, just filling up that bathtub halfway, you know, first keep yourself in it, you know, so you can take on a little extra heat.
Right.
And, you know, you submerge yourself in that, not too full, and, you know, it's kind of like being back in the womb, and you'd be surprised how relaxed a state you can become. And just try to keep a focus on what's going through your mind, and that you might be surprised when you're in a really deep relaxation trance state. It's almost like self-hypnosis. You know, I don't really believe in going to a doctor or a hypnotist or anything like that, but I do believe in using self-hypnosis. And all I'm talking about there is just accessing deep relaxation states.
people take for granted, I think, that you can alter your brain state and the way that your brain functions in a given setting or circumstance, and that this may enable you to think and maybe reach different kind of planes of existence and plateaus within the mind. And when it comes to talking about peak experiences, extraplanetary experiences, different brain states, relaxation, meditation, all these sorts of things, in your research into all this, Dr. Stryker, tell us how your own beliefs and views have changed, or has your own spirituality been affected or deepened?
Well, of course it has. You know, I'm really in the most deepest state of spirituality I ever have been, and I think a lot of it has to do with just being able to do the kind of work that I'm doing right now. I feel pretty blessed. I run a nonprofit corporation called Divine Spark, which is basically devoted its time and energy to helping poor and in need people, homeless people, high risk homeless people, and we also spend time on Indian reservations. And that work has been most profound because it gives me access to different cultures within our own culture. Just going out and working with people on a, let's say, Native American Indian reservation, and getting involved with the people and getting involved with their spirituality has taught me so much. Talking about accessing deeper parts of ourselves, I remember the first time I went into a sweat lodge, let's say, it's so hot in there. You think, oh my God, I can't stand it. But then you learn to discipline your mind by concentrating on different things, and be surprised, through that experience what I've learned, and the vision quest and the sun dances. These all had profound meaning for me. In a way, it's really, even to this day, difficult for me to talk about. It was so profound because I had such incredible experiences of accessing deeper parts of myself. So basically what I'm trying to say is that through deprivation, a lot of times, like a vision quest is basically done, you go 4 days, 4 nights without eating or drinking. That's a long time. As somebody that's used to eating 3 meals a day and plus whatever else.
Oh yeah.
So that through that deprivation, you get a whole new meaning of what's really important to a person, So, and I'm not telling anybody to go out and do this without guidance either, but you kind of work up to that 4 days and four nights. But once it's accomplished, you prioritize, different parts of your life. What's really important now? And I think, at least for me, it got to me down to understanding that I can't be preoccupied with materialism any longer. That's just a waste of time for me, personally. But, if I can get into more of the deeper spiritual concepts, it's so rewarding because it gives me a really incredible feeling of contentment and well-being that I really can't get through, material possessions.
But can you get it from interaction with others?
I'm sorry, what was that? What's the question?
I asked, could you get that same sort of a sensation, do you think, from interaction that you have with others?
Well, certainly. Being of service to others, even like I'm here with you right now, I'm basically being of service to you and your listeners and hopefully sharing something that, will be helpful to them. And that's, I basically have changed my life to that sense, probably for the last 20 years, just being service-oriented. Very happy with that. Just being a benefit to others, and I think a lot of that had to do with not only with the experiences, in my book that I talk about the experiencers and what that was one of the greatest changes they realized in through their experience, too, is to be of service to others. I agree with that, and not only do I agree with that, but I live that concept.
You do. I'm reminded of that adage, we are all on the path, we know not where we're going, but we are on our way. And you are clearly one of those individuals who is on his way. Thomas James Stryker, PhD, he is author of Extraplanetary Experiences, and I want to thank you wholeheartedly for bringing your service here to the Gray Alien Report and talking to the listeners.
Right.
And why it truly has been a blessing. And briefly, before I let you go, I do want to just say I love the Divine Spark organization and what you've done there. Can you tell us where people can learn more about that and also the rest of your work?
Sure. Well, Divine Spark has a website. It's www.divinespark.us for United States. You can get a lot of information on our website. You can get the book at, of course, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble's, and through the publisher Baring Company out of Vermont. It's called Extraplanetary Experiences, Alien-Human Contact and the Expansion of Consciousness. And I also have a private website, my own personal website, that's www.thomasstriker.com, where I put a lot of my radio interviews on there, and I was also on Coast to Coast recently, and I don't have that on there, but I really like to talk with people, especially if they feel they've had an experience that they want to share with me. But it's not necessary or a priority, but I do appreciate people calling, and, you know, that's what I'm here for, is to be available and help guide people wherever you're going next.
That's a good fellow right there. And I tell you what, if it helps in guiding people, we're more than happy to supply this interview to you for you to add your website just as well.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. We hope people will enjoy it as much as we have enjoyed talking with you. Dr. Stryker, we hope you'll join us again at some point in the future on the Gray Alien Report, and do always keep us up to date with what you've got going on in your ongoing research, okay?
Well, I'd certainly like to do that, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, many blessings to you. We'll turn you loose for now, and thanks again for joining us here on the Gray Alien Report. That was Thomas James Stryker, Ph.D., indeed one of those guys who, well, you know, you'd like to hear a little bit more from just because of that good energy he puts out. He definitely puts out a lot of that. When we come back here on the Gray Alien Report, we're going to touch on a few of the news stories of the week, and then eventually, well, we'll get around to wrapping things up. But we're not done just yet. In fact, we may have only begun to fight. It's a spiritual battle, my friends, and we're going to lead you right to the front line here when we come back here on the Gray Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the Inception Radio Network.com. We'll see you there.
Hi, this. Welcome back to the program. Again, we just heard from Thomas James Stryker, Ph.D. His new book is Extraplanetary Experiences, Alien-Human Contact, and the Expansion of Consciousness. You know, when it comes to the expansion of consciousness, something that we like to address frequently on this program, there are times, I'm afraid, when we do feel, or at least I know I personally feel, a bit like we're moving backwards rather than making progressive movement forward. And I think that in this instance, this past week, we've all been a little shaken in terms of what happened out there in Colorado. Here I'm talking about UFOs over Colorado. And there was this tragic incident that took place at the opening. It was a late night opening of The Dark Knight Rises, the film. During which this idiot, this non-enlightened type, decides to go out there and, well, I'll just say this. We all know what happened, what the shooter did. Launching tear gas into the theater and then going in there and shooting the place up. It was terrible. All the actors that are the key players appearing in the film, Christian Bale and Anne Hathaway, and many of the others, Gary Oldman, I know, had made a statement. Many of them have actually gone to Colorado, as I understand, and have been involved in other different ways and spoken out about the tragedy of this crime. And I posted online the morning that the news had broken, the morning following the shooting, that even from the very darkest night, together we will rise. And that's true. It's incidents like this that remind us. It's, you know, and I think it was best said by actor Christian Bale, of course, who plays Bruce Wayne in Batman in the film series. I couldn't begin to imagine the pain that those families are going through, but my heart goes out to them truly. And I'd like to share that sentiment right now. I too, having not been there, having not gone through that loss, it must be difficult to even imagine the kind of pain that the families are going through. And I think that this is a great opportunity for us not only to express a bit of sensitivity, but also to recognize and to try and reach out. You know, I talk about cosmic love on this program a good bit. And in this instance, this is, I think, a fine example of where we need to reach out to one another and to join together. You know, reach for that inner connectedness that we all share and send some of that energy. Whatever that energy is, I'm sure a lot of people roll their eyes when I refer to it as an energy, but there are energies, I think, okay? There are manifestations that well up from within us, and when we are called to do good work in this world, whatever that is, it may not necessarily be energy in the materialistic matter and energy sense, but there is a force, if you will, okay? An intention, a drive that will erupt from within the individual and will move us to action. This is one of those times where I think that we all need to reach within and try and send as much positivity and much of that good, quote-unquote, energy, you know, out to those people as we can. Because just as sure as we are going to try and do that, there are others out there who, unfortunately, would prefer to take a little different approach, wouldn't they? Yes, I'm talking about our good friends or our dear friends out there at the Westboro Baptist Church. We all know these folks from their inane and ridiculous activity going and picketing the funerals of fallen soldiers and things like this. Now, I don't care if you agree with or disagree with foreign military conflicts that we're involved with right now. I have my own feelings about those kinds of things, but I'm sorry, when our young men and women die in battle, you don't go and you hold hateful flags and signs and jump up and down and make a scene at the funeral of these young people. That is absolutely absurd. Okay, and Reverend Phelps, this fellow out there who's in charge of this Westboro Baptist Church, you know, there was a segment on the old Micah Hanks radio program that I did about them. I had all these wonderful sound bites. I remember we had Phelps saying such brilliant scriptural adages as, "They're going to make you eat your babies." Oh, I loved that one. "And then you're going to eat each other." And of course, in that hateful, hateful rhetoric that he ties together beautifully with regard to homosexuality or anything else that he finds personally and philosophically distasteful. Well, I hear that following the shooting that occurred in Colorado that really, literally had me depressed the morning after this happened. In fact, I called Chris Hayes up here and I said, we're going to see the Dark Knight today, because I'm telling you, when something like this happens, people naturally, they shy away. They're like, oh my God, what if that happens someplace else? What if we're all in danger? We cannot live in fear. We cannot live in fear of what could potentially happen because of what some idiot has done. And Chris and I rushed out to go see the movie that night. And it just makes me so sick to think that despite the troubled nature of that event and how we've all felt in the aftermath of it, that these people, okay, apparently, Matt, didn't you say that you had a story here that the Westboro Baptist Church decided that they would announce they were going to show up and picket the funerals of some of those who were killed in that shooting?
Yes, apparently there was going to be a big vigil or, you know, something like this for all of the victims that in that theater. It was going to be a big group thing, and Westboro decided to announce that they would be picketing this vigil.
Oh, and, good! Brilliant!
And actually, I thought one of the coolest parts about this story was that the people who put on the Denver Comic Con actually did a call to arms on Facebook and all their other fan pages and all that, and said, anybody who has volunteered at Comic Con or any other con, we want you to put on your Denver Comic Con shirts, and we want you to go form a human wall around this, you know, this vigil, and keep out Westboro Baptist Church. But the thing is apparently Westboro Baptist Church crapped out on us this time.
Oh.
Photoshopped images of themselves there and weren't really there at all.
Wait a minute. So, wait, you mean they actually went to the trouble to Photoshop images
yes.
to make it appear that they had been there? You know, unfortunately, they've gotten so much media attention over the years that now when they show up, people are armed and ready with, you know, rotten cabbages and tomatoes
oh, yeah.
ready to throw, or worse, you know. But I'll tell you, it's funny. There's another Batman tie-in here. You know, they came here to Asheville a few years ago and were doing their picketing down, I believe, in front of the All Souls Cathedral in Biltmore. And I thought, many years ago, wouldn't it be hilarious if we put together an organization? Here's what we're going to call it. Batman Squad. Okay? And what I envisioned was, imagine the Westboro Baptist people are out there and they're jumping up and down picketing and all. And off in the distance, coming down the sidewalk, down the hill toward them, are 35 or 40 people in Batman suits walking, you know, I mean, the capes flowing, the Batman squad. And they go down there with water guns and just torture these people with water guns. Now, granted, they're real careful about what they do. They're very careful about, you know, being within the proper jurisdictions of their freedom of speech. They know how the right and the proper distance to be away from a building. And even though what they're doing is what I would call very hateful, they're careful enough about how they do it so that they are within their rights when they go about these things. But nonetheless, I just thought it would be hilarious if, like, you know, 50 people in Batman costumes showed up with water guns and just, you know, made the afternoon a living hell for them while they stood there picketing this. So, you know, I wish somebody had done that more recently, but unfortunately yeah. they didn't show up. They didn't make the appearance, huh?
Yeah, and the great thing is this is not the first time this past week that they've what's an easy way to put this? Made asses out of themselves.
Okay.
this is actually the second, because as you know, Westboro Baptist Church and Fred Phelps and all the other wonderfully insane people in the world feel that our president is the Antichrist.
Well, every president's the Antichrist,
well, of course,
right?
Yeah, but
of
this
course.
Antichrist also went to Mars.
Oh, yeah. Well, but the last one was the Antichrist, too, wasn't he?
Who knows? It's so hard to keep up with Antichrist these days.
Anyway, but, we're going to go west of the Rockies and take. We're going to open a special line just for Antichrists
yeah.
now. Okay, sorry, go ahead, Matt.
But apparently, during Obama's inauguration, Fred Phelps stated that from the day he was inaugurated, he had 42 months. 42 months in office until he would be, I guess, taken away or killed, or some action would prevent him from being in office any longer.
Hmm.
Well, we just hit the 42 months period on the 20th. As Nate Phelps, Fred Phelps' son,
uh-huh.
who actually now speaks out against
right.
Westboro, and he wrote an article on the Huffington Post this past weekend, basically calling out his father and saying, well, 42 months is up and he's still in office. So
now, I've heard Nate talk before, and now Nate, if I'm correct, is an atheist also, isn't he? I mean he's gotten so far away from it that he's, you know, fallen away from religion altogether because of what he believed was, I mean, really very harmful you know, psychological manipulation it was really very difficult for him as a child, he and many of the others there at the church. I don't think he's the only one who's kind of defected and spoken out against what's going on there at Westboro.
I believe there was a daughter.
Yeah.
I
think there was, too, or a granddaughter, maybe.
Maybe that.
But the thing is that, indeed, what we see going on here, there is a lot of, you know, manipulation and suggestion, you know, and these, you know, a lot of the children who are raised up there in the church, you know, they're brought up from an age where, at that impressionable period in their lives, they're being fed information that they don't really know whether it is right or wrong, and, of course, they're brought up into this kind of a ideology, this ideology of extremism. Now, Chris, I do want to give you an opportunity, being the guy who likes to rant about religion here on the program. Do you have one feeling, you know, one way or the other, with regard to Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church?
I do, yes. I feel like...
because I've got the... I'm just going to... Before you sit there and waste the airspace, okay, I'm going to tell you, you have the microphone if you'd like to talk about this.
Well, I mean, I feel like a lot of people get onto them for not being Christian at all, or for basically being the antithesis of what it means to be Christian, when, in fact, they're the only ones who have the courage to be truly, you know, along with canonical Bible, truly, truly Christian. I mean, if you look at things, you know, as extreme as them, maybe not, maybe a little more extreme than them, like the Inquisition and things like that.
Sure.
That is true Christianity at work, not the middle of the road selective verse choosers, but the super extreme people. That is what the Bible breeds. And that is what it actually says.
Now,
so they are, in fact, following the Word of God.
Now you're being...
Or the Bible, not the Word of God.
Now, you're being mildly satirical here. I do want to point out, because people... He's like, no, I'm not. No, because I'm just waiting for somebody to hear just that soundbite and be like, wait, what did Chris Hayes just say?
Well, but the thing is I, you know, to... You know, play devil's advocate with what you just said. Isn't this interpretation? Isn't that spirituality open to interpretation?
No. They're following the actual literal words in the book. They are doing what the book says.
But the thing is that, again, that is interpretation. You know, for instance, well, I could give you a lot of examples, but I don't want to get into the utilization of English words that are derogatory, which the Westboro Baptist Church, especially Fred Phelps, typically, consistently, and habitually even, misuse for purposes of outlining what his warped interpretation of the scriptures are. It's pretty sick. But I mean, anyone can go online and look on YouTube for Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps, and you'll find all kinds of audio sound bites and things like that. I don't have to tell you what the guy says. It's all out there. I'll just tell you, it's bad news. I mean, like, bad news.
I mean, just to clear things up before people start sending horrible hate mail towards me at producer@graylianreport.com, I do like to make the distinction between, a Christian and Christ-like people. Huge difference.
Well, you know, I don't like to generalize, though. I mean, there are... I know some wonderful people who, you know, in my life have called themselves, you know, members of the Church of Satan. I've known wonderful people who have said that they were, you know, evangelical Christians. I've known wonderful people in my lifetime who said that they were atheists. And, you know, in fact, Chris, you identify yourself as an atheist, although I debate that at times myself. But you know, you are a person who I still think has a deep spiritual side, and I consider you a wonderful person. I've also met people from all those various walks of life who maybe weren't such wonderful people, and who I had extreme philosophical differences with. I've had you know, many instances where I've known a person who claims to you know, be a regular Sunday morning church goer, but throughout the work week, you know, they'll do anything that they want to under this notion that they'll show up on Sunday morning at church and everything will be okay. But I will not generalize and say that one denomination or one particular religion does that more than another. I love it when people try and attack Christianity and for instance, say, oh, this is what the Christians have done, and then they'll point to, you know, the sorts of things that were going on during the Crusades or what was going on during the Inquisition. These sorts of things. Those are great examples. And Chris, you can look at me however you want to, but you know what? I've known many people who have said, I am a Christian and that this is what I do, and they never were inquisitors, nor did they march children off into a crusade or anything like that to try and, you know, go to the Holy Land and find holy relics. I'm sorry, these sorts of things have happened historically. But as a civilization, humanity has moved forward and we're a lot different today. Now, that doesn't excuse people who still, in the name of God or anybody else, whether it be the Judeo-Christian God or any other God, who go forth and commit atrocious acts and nonetheless think that they're justified religiously. Sure, it still happens, but I don't necessarily think that it's really a good idea for us always to just generalize based on, well, this is what somebody may have done several hundreds of years ago. I think there are a lot of prejudices that kind of stem from interpretation of the past and versus the present. Again, I've known wonderful people in my life who've called themselves a lot of different things, and some who don't say that they're anything at all, and they're still fine people. You know, fundamentally, I think what it comes down to is, you know, who are you? How are you going to act? What are you going to do? And if you say that you're going to do these things and that these are the principles that you live by, can you walk the walk as well as talk the talk? And that's why I say, you know, having had a Christian upbringing, but having also studied, you know, the Vedic texts that Thomas Stryker was talking about. And by the way, you know, the Swami who wrote that book, that was actually... those weren't Vedic texts, but he was actually the fellow who was commonly known as the founder of the Hare Krishna movement. Now, you know, I don't necessarily prescribe to all that either, But I mentioned that book because the title of the book was called Easy Journey to Outer Space, or to Other Planets, rather. And that sounded very similar to the concept put forth in his book, Extraplanetary Experiences, that Thomas Stryker was talking about. I've been a person personally who has tried to look at various different aspects of religion, spirituality, culture, and tradition throughout all the world and throughout history. And yeah, you do see that there are a lot of consistencies from culture to culture and religious practice and tradition to another. There are a lot of changes and there are a lot of differences too. But I think that we can take wisdom from all these things and learn from them. Many would tell you today that, well, you're deceived if you do that. I think that there is a careful and reasonable way to go about the act of acquiring knowledge and wisdom. And I feel personally blessed that those who listen to this program feel that they can attain, well, if not always wisdom, at least entertainment from this program. But we do work hard at trying to bring a bit of knowledge and wisdom to our listenership. May you grow a bit wiser every week and upon every listening. And with that, we must bid you adieu, my friends. On behalf of John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, Holly, wherever she's been around here, and of course, yours truly, your ever-loving mouth of the South, Mr. Micah Hanks, your dark angel here in the Moho, we bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange.